seagull. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron. You are listening to Bicycle Talk, episode 494, to be broadcast Wednesday, August 12th on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. I think she's still sleeping. If you are watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment and I might be able to respond. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, the bicycle calendar, bicycle advocacy, the upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, all sorts of things that pertain to bicycles, of course. If you have a comment, you'd like to contribute information to the show and are listening to me on Facebook Live, you can just make your comment right down here below, or you can simply drop me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my YouTube channel, Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Very good. Ron's Rant of the Week. New York Police Department de-escalates its bummer streets policy at this week's car-free DOT event. Yeah. The big summer street festival was mostly, once again, a joyous event, though the NYPD did what it could to spoil the fun again. I'll talk about that a little bit more in the show. Sometimes you should just stay away, let people have fun. Anyway, and just when you think you've seen it all, yeah, I know, here comes another rant for you. Padded bra cheating claim rocks Tour de France. The Tour de France Femmes, as bizarre theory swirls around cycling. I'll bet you can't wait for this one. Anyway, we'll get to that a little bit later in the show also. Okay, that's enough of ranting for the week. So on a positive side, I'm sorry I've been away, but I have this crazy job call. I am the registrar of voters in town, so I am one of two of us. And I've been busy doing early voting, and so I've been away, and that's why you haven't heard me on the air for a few weeks, which is kind of a bummer because, you know, it was right after the Tour de France, but I'm working a lot right now, so I haven't had time to put together a show. That's why I'm putting it on really early this morning, and hopefully it will get out into the airways this week. So anyway, Tour de France wrap up. That's what I didn't get to do. Did you see the final stage? Did you watch this Tour de France? It was very interesting. Yeah, there was one guy that kind of dominated the whole thing. There's no question about that. But there were some highlights. There were some really, really cool highlights. So anyway, as I said, did you see the final stage, or shall I say stages? It was interesting. Anyway, I'll have more information about that later on in the show. The Tour de Femmes is on and over at this point. Yesterday was their last stage. So, yeah, they're done. I'll have more information about that later on in the show. And, of course, the Mechanical Minute and Bicycle Tips. The performance metric. What separates Tour de France riders from their competitors? Yeah. Anyway, there's a bunch of things here. This was done through Bicycling Magazine, and they explained why the best riders can keep producing big efforts late in the race and how regular cyclists can train at that ability. I think not, but that's all right. And then here you go. This one's going to be fun, actually. How to become a professional cyclist. How would you like to be a professional cyclist? What do you think? Wouldn't that be fun? 17 steps. Very easy, right? Nothing to it. No, it takes a lot of talent. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of dedication. But, you know, to become a professional cyclist, and do you start racing to gain experience and recognition? You train consistently, increase your riding time, and include strength training to enhance your performance. So, this is an interesting article I saw, and I thought it would be kind of fun to talk about. And as a tip, as a Pedlerun tip, how to become a professional cyclist. Okay, first of all, let's see here. Set your goals. Clear and attainable goals are essential for anyone aspiring to become a professional cyclist. Your goals will provide direction and motivation, helping you to stay motivated. That's kind of a life lesson, I think. That's not just for being a professional cyclist. I think that that's kind of a thing that you would do in life. But anyway, it's also what works for cycling or any athletic type event. Defining your professional cycling goals. Again, these could go for just your normal, everyday person who's out riding their bike and they want to get a little bit better on their bike, as well as someone who is aspiring to be a pro. Identify your aspirations. Decide what kind of professional cyclist you want to be. And do you aim to compete in road races, maintain mountain biking, or track racing? Research requirements. Understand the qualifications and standards required for professional cyclists in your chosen discipline. And set realistic objectives. Consider your current fitness levels, skills, and resources to ensure your goals are attainable. And short-term versus long-term goals, well, thought-out goals can set a process that can make a journey more manageable and less overwhelming. I would seriously consider at this point hiring a coach, but that's beside the point. Maybe you are your own coach. Maybe you are your own worst enemy. You never know. And you could be very hard on yourself. But until you really evaluate numbers and really understand it and study it, it's kind of hard to go there. So short-term goals, you achieve these by every few months out of a year, you kind of take a look at where you are, where you were last year. It really has a lot to do with documentation and being able to look back to see where you were and what was happening. I found that I did keep a written log back in the day because we didn't have computers. Well, we had computers, but they were way too big to work with. Anyway, we didn't have a computer in the palm of our hand like we do now. But anyway, I kept a log and I could take a look at it. And if I was at, let's say, April 15th of the current year and I was feeling like I was really tired and what's wrong, oh my goodness, I'd look back at where I was at previous year. And when you look back at that, you get to take a look at the fact that this is normal because you've been putting in a lot of miles, or maybe you put in too many miles. Maybe you have been riding more aggressively one year than you were another year. You gotta pay really close attention to all those things. Super important. And regular evaluations and long-term goals are, of course, in there too. Long-term goals being, you know, what is that big event that I'm looking for? And how do I work my way up to it? And also just kind of assessing how your body's feeling and how you're going to be able to react to that. A lot of people don't know their bodies as well as they think they do. And my big one that I learned over the years and I'm still learning is rest. Did I mention rest? Yeah, rest is like such a key piece of how it all works. And in order to understand whether you need rest or not, you really have to pay attention to basic things like heart rate and, you know, resting heart rate in the morning, just little simple things like that. There's a lot of little indicators that are out there. And we have all the electronics now to do this. You know, we have heart rate monitors. We have ways of checking our VO2 max on a test. We have a lot of different things we can do. So anyway, special milestones along the way. Fitness benchmarks. You set targets for your physical conditioning, such as achieving a particular VO2 max level. I just mentioned that, right? Reducing body fat percentage or improving endurance. Skill developments, you want to focus on enhancing your cycling skills, including bike handling, climbing, descending, and sprinting. I was, when we were up at the University of Connecticut yesterday, shutting down the polling station that we have on campus, I was talking to the driver that was with me as we were going to pick up equipment, and I said, you know, I used to remember back in when Yukon was just so quiet and sleepy, a little sleepy little college town, and I would ride my bike up there and I would just do corners. I would just go blasting through the corners as fast as I could because there's no one on campus in the summer, and it was great. Now it's construction everywhere, and there's never a quiet time. But if you have a quiet place that you can do that, maybe an industrial park on the weekend, or you know, some place that you know you're not going to get yourself in trouble with cars, it's really good to work on those cornering skills and, you know, building your confidence, learning how to read lines, that sort of thing. It's real, real important. Of course, the downhills, again, that's another one. Learn how to descend. And if you're a great climber, it just doesn't matter if you can't descend. So there's things you need to work on and always work on. And don't just take it for granted that I'm good at this, I can just do this. It doesn't really work out that way. You got to practice. And you create yourself a training plan for that. And you, again, as you create that training plan, you're looking for a well-structured plan. And you're trying to develop your physical and mental stamina required for being a professional cyclist. Yeah, you know what? They're in a different world. I'm going to tell you right now, if you're listening to this and you are your, you know, basic recreational cyclist, maybe your commute back and forth to work, and somebody said, hey, you're pretty fast, you should try about racing your bike, that sort of thing, this is a different animal altogether. I can't imagine being a professional cyclist. First thing I would test, the first thing, first and foremost, is I would get my VO2 max tested. Because if you're not able to process oxygen at a world-class level, you probably don't have a very strong future in being a professional cyclist. These guys are, right now, we're looking at the Jonas Vingegaards and the Tadej Pogačars of the world, and they are machines for processing oxygen. And that makes all the difference in the world. That's why they're able to maintain 90 to 100 RPMs on a 14% grade. It's just, they're supermen. They really are. It's kind of cool to watch and see the development of it. But we haven't seen big VO2 maxes like this since back in the days of Greg LeMond, who is one of our more famous cyclists here in the United States. And his VO2 max was 93, which is really, really high. And that's what made him phenomenally better than a lot of the other riders that were out there, is that he had this impressive way of processing oxygen, which makes all the difference in the world. Daily training, yeah, you got to really focus on that. And you got to remember that if you're training really hard one day and you know, you've just really done the work like you were supposed to do, the next day is probably either going to be incredibly hard for you to try to do the same thing, or you really need a rest day in between. I'm a big believer in rest days. Hard day, easy day. Hard day, easy day. And then when I was really hitting the peak of my fitness, I would put two hard days in a row and in the middle of the week. So I had enough time to recover for the weekend so that when I would race my bike on the weekend, I would have some gas in the tank, so to speak. I just have a little bit of a you know, extra kick for the weekend. But if you go too hard, too fast, too soon, you are going to suffer from, yeah, you got it, the two disease. Don't do it. So here's an example. Monday, you know, easy day, rest, light or recovery ride, that sort of thing. Tuesday, interval training. So you're going to go out, you're going to find a place where you can do some hard pop intervals, and that's what you do on Tuesday. Remember, those days are not long days when you're doing the real hard work like that. On Wednesday, there's your long day. It's an endurance ride. You're going to go out, pack up your pockets with lots of food, you're going to have a couple of water bottles on your bike, and you're going to go out and you're just going to ride long, not fast, long. And then on Thursday, that's when you do your strength training. And your strength training can be, it can be in or out of the gym. You can do it on your bike. You can do it by pushing big ears on your bike. You just have to be very, very careful about your knees when you do that sort of thing. I read an article a number of years ago from a professional cyclist, and he said he did all of his strength, you know, all of his counterparts were doing strength training in the weight room and doing all this stuff. He found it much more effective to do it on his bike. He just put it into a much bigger gear, and then he forced himself to really push and pull through and keep his power even all the way around, and he got more from it than he did from lifting. So whatever works for you, it really is what is best for you. Friday is a tempo ride, so you're going to be a little bit upbeat. You're going to be over that endurance ride pace. You're going to be picking up a little bit, you know, keeping your heart rate up in the, you know, high. Ooh, you're looking like high 70%, maybe tapping into 80% a little bit. You know, tempo, just kind of, you know, clean the pipes out, as I used to call it, you know, get things working. And then back on Saturday, you're back at that long endurance ride again. And again, you're packing your pockets full of food. And I'm not a big believer in stopping a lot. If I'm actually quote unquote training on my bike, I will stop a lot. If I'm out for a ride with Fran and we stop at a cafe and we, you know, sit and enjoy some food. The only problem I have with stopping often is that it takes me a while to get warm back up again. And that can be annoying if you're trying to use this for some sort of training. So, you have to know when to relax and when not to relax. And Sunday could be a recovery ride. That'd be the perfect ride to do that. And then you're back at it again. So you're kind of setting, you know, a pattern, really, as far as your training goes. And that is the way to understand why structured training programs work well. They give you the guidance and direction. They give you progressive overload, balanced development, injury prevention, motivation and accountability. So structure is key, and keeping track of it, once again, is really, really important to do when you're focusing on getting yourself better. And your training and conditioning, you want to build a strong foundation. I think that weight work and stretching routines like yoga, that sort of thing in the wintertime, some indoor cycling in the wintertime with hard intervals, but everything is an hour or less for sure. I think that they're really, really beneficial as far as building a strong foundation goes. The weights, you can use light weights, high repetitions for endurance training. You can use heavy weights with, you know, short intervals of weight usage. So you're really keeping your weights pretty heavy, and you can only do a certain number of repetitions before you go to exhaustion. So you got to be careful about all this. And before you dive into advanced training, remember, you had to meet basic fitness criteria, and things like your cardiovascular fitness needs to be, I'm assuming, pretty good because you've been riding your bike a lot. So your cardiovascular fitness is probably pretty good. Your muscular strength is really important, particularly in the legs and the core and the upper body, because it helps you improve power output and stability on your bike. And of course, your flexibility, I talked about that earlier. I used to not be a big believer in yoga and yoga stretches and that sort of thing. Now I teach it. So you know what? It's a really, really, really good thing. I have this friend, Phil. He's out in the Midwest, and he is master's racer, and I worked with him when I worked for Louis Garneau, and he is the most flexible guy I have ever seen. He can put his hands flat down on the ground when he bends over, and he said he's been stretching his whole life, and his friends call him Gumby. And he's, for any of you who know what Gumby is out there, anyway, he claims that that flexibility is his secret sauce. It's the thing that has made him so fast on his bike because he's maintained his flexibility over the years. So, worth looking into for sure. Can you get your flexibility back as you get older? Well, you can help with your flexibility as you get older, but if you let it go for too long, I'm going to tell you, it is a long journey to get that kind of flexibility back. And I'm sure it can be done, but I am not that person. I've tried and tried, and I teach classes on flexibility, and maybe that ship has passed, so to speak. It just gets really hard. But if you are going to do endurance training, you got regular long rides at a moderate pace will help build your stamina. So that's good for, and you know, if you're doing longer events. Tempo rides, they maintain a steady, challenging pace, slightly below race intensity, and they help improve your ability to sustain high efforts. Interval training, incorporating high-intensity interval training. Everybody talks about it, HIIT. It's very, very popular. It seems to come and go at the gyms, and all of a sudden it's the hot thing everybody's doing. I've been doing it since the 70s, but you know, we didn't call it anything back then. We just did it. Hill repeats, my favorites. I was one of those guys who was blessed with a strength to weight ratio that was like no other around me. So I was able to go out to hills, and even though I didn't have a great VO2 max, I could climb hills. Boy, could I climb hills. And I tended to be, because my VO2 is very low, I tended to be more of a muscly, out-of-the-saddle type climber. But when you don't have a lot to carry up the hill, it makes a big, big difference. So Hill Repeats and I became good friends because they seemed to help me with all my all-around fitness also. And I remember reading an article way back in the day, and it was about, you know, it was a professional bike racer, and he was talking about his experiences and what he did to train. And he said he was never a great sprinter because he was, you know, long, lanky, skinny, high strength to weight ratio, but really hard to push big gears kind of guy. And he said that he would use the hills, especially at the last part of the hill, like 75% up a hill, he would sprint as hard as he could at the top of the hill, and it improved his sprinting skills. So, you know, there's little things you can do for sure, but always remember recovery rides. Recovery rides are just really important. Gradually increasing your training intensity is a way to build. And so once again, you're looking at that log. What did I do last week? What did I do last month? A friend of mine had a plan. He was working with a coach, and he had 3 weeks of intense training, getting a little harder each week. And then he had 1 week that was just totally like cool breeze, you know, go slow. Heart rate down, zone two, don't let it hit, go over to zone two at all, just really easy spin out type stuff. And that seemed to help him really a lot as far as his building his strength. And he was a sprinter. He was one of these guys that could, like, you know, blow out a sprint, leave everybody behind him. But that was the way he was training. And, you know, he's putting in, at that time, I think David's putting in about 10,000 miles a year or something like that. But very talented rider. Progressive overload principles. So incremental increases, 10% a week, no more. That's it. The 10% rule is a great rule. And it's, you'll know it if you went over it, like all of a sudden you're, well, let's say you're out, you're doing, let's call it 30 mile rides every day. And then you jumping up from 30 miles, 10%, it's only going to be 33 miles, right? But you decide, because you are, you know, now Superman, that you're going to do a 60 mile ride, and you can't figure out why you're so tired the next day. 10% rule, folks, 10% rule. Gradually work your way towards it. Even if you're working up towards a goal of, let's say you're working at a goal of, you know, doing your first 100-mile century ride, you look at the date that you're looking to do that and you walk backwards 10%. Just walk backwards all the way down to where you currently are. And that is the way you base your training. You just increase by 10% each week until you get up to that number. And it's just a little math and a little bit of sitting down and figuring it out logistically as how to do it. But there's ways to do it for sure. Monitor your progress and adjust your training intensity. Yep, once again, we're going back to that log. We're going back to the paperwork. Or maybe you keep it on an Excel spreadsheet because you're a computer person. Maybe you do what I like to do now because I'm too lazy to type, and you do audio. And you can put text down by using your voice also. And that's another way of looking at it. And it'll bring it to a point where you can go back and you can evaluate it. Listening to your body. Pay attention to the signs of fatigue and discomfort. If you experience persistent pain or exhaustion, reduce your training load and prioritize your recovery. It's not going to affect you in a negative way to take it easy. It will affect you in a negative way to keep pushing harder and harder and harder. And I would seriously consider a coach if you're really getting serious about this sort of thing, or a mentor. Maybe it's an old guy bike racer like myself that might be able to give you some tips from what he's learned over the years. Maybe it's your best friend that you go out and ride with all the time, and you guys chat all the time, and so you're able to exchange information with one another, exchange ideas with one another. I think that's really good. And of course, cross-training for cyclists is always a good thing too, especially if you live in a wintry area, so you get the opportunity to skate or ski or do something like that. And it'll help you with incorporating different exercises, will help you with muscle balance and cardiovascular fitness and mental refreshment. You know, taking a break from the thing you do all the time is a big, big deal. And injury prevention, huge, especially if you're using different muscles and you're able to strengthen them in different ways. It will help you balance out your body. So those are all important. Cross-training activities could be running, swimming, strength training, yoga, rowing, hiking. There's a lot of things. Tell you what, the hiking thing, if you're a cyclist, you ride a lot, and then you decide that you're going to go out and start walking a lot, your hips are going to talk to you like they've never talked to you before. It's a different engagement. It really is. And if you walk with people that really like to walk and or use walking for transportation like my son does, you got to train for that to go. When I go see my son, I've got to train for it because he walks and he really walks. So it's a different effort, and I may be in great shape from riding my bike, but I'm not so in such good shape for walking. So balancing things out and cross training over does make a difference, and it will help you overall. So really, really important. Skills development, you know, we talked about that earlier, corners. I love to find a place that's quiet enough that I can go ripping through and do corners without concern. Riding at what I call mindless abandon, that really teaches you a lot about how to handle your bike, especially in tricky situations. So I think that's really good. You know me, I'm a big cyclocross fan. If anything at all, if you want to increase your ability to handle your bike, take a season and do cross. Or just have a cross bike on hand that you can go out occasionally and ride around on. And take it out to a field or into the woods or whatever. And, you know, learn how to handle the bike when the bike is not necessarily going where you want it to go. And those are important skills to work on. So improve your pedaling efficiency, smoothing out your pedal stroke. That is a biggie. Of course, best way to do that is on the infamous rollers in the wintertime. You can't get any smoother than that, because if you're not smooth, you fall off. So it's pretty simple. Cadence management. Most rides, you're going to maintain a consistent cadence between 80 and 100 RPMs, and it helps reduce muscle fatigue and optimize your energy use. Gear shifting, learn how to shift. Seems simple enough, right? But if you're not paying attention to shifting soon enough or late enough or whatever it is, and considering your situation, I see a lot of riders that ride way too big a gear into the bottom of a hill, and then they can't figure out why others just leave them behind, because they had the wherewithal to shift earlier and try to keep that cadence level high enough so that they didn't really affect the pedal stroke. There's a lot of things you can play with. And they also talk here about, cleat positioning and all. Again, hire a professional on that. It's definitely worth it. They'll set you up right, and they'll make sure that you don't do any damage or have any concerns with your knees because of that. Mastering bike handling skills. Cornering, practice. You're entering the turn. You're riding through the turn. You're focusing on where you're going to be as you get out of the turn. It's all about looking where you're going, not where you are. So cornering is a skill, and it is something that I still have a pretty good skill with my cornering. And oftentimes, if I'm on a group ride, I'll go through a corner. I'll know I really nailed it, hit it right. And I'll look over my shoulder, and I'll see that I got 20 feet on the people that were with me just by going through the corner efficiently. So there's little things like that that make a difference. Descending, learn how to keep a low center of gravity, look ahead, and using both brakes efficiently. Relax your grip on the handlebars and maintain better control. As I like to say, be one with your bike, grasshopper. You want to really become part of your machine. That machine that you're riding on, that bicycle that you're riding on, can do anything at all that you want it to do, but you have to learn how to respect it, and you have to learn how to become one with it. It's really important. It takes time. There's a little zen to this. But it makes a difference, and it makes a difference overall on your fatigue level. It makes a difference overall on your safety. There's just so many different things. Obstacle avoidance, practice sudden swerves and bunny hops. I'm not into sudden swerves. I don't like that, because if I'm riding with anyone, that's going to create a bad message to anyone behind me. I will bunny hop. I definitely have the ability to lift my bike up off the road to avoid a pothole or a stone or something in the road. But again, takes practice, and that's another one of those things. That's another one of those enhancements you can get when you're a cyclocross rider. So that's good. Track stands. Yeah, we used to do these. I can't do them as well as I used to, but coming to a stop sign or a stoplight and just being able to hold yourself still and never take your feet off the pedals, that's a trick. Takes practice, once again. Do it in a field. Trust me. Soft surface underneath you is best place to practice that. And you want to have a little bit of an upgrade when you do that. So you're putting pressure against the upgrade with the pedal. So anyway, then it gets even trickier, because then you start to need to understand racetrack tactics and strategies. And let me tell you, find a mentor. Find someone who's been there and done that. Ask a lot of questions. Learn as much as you can, because it really, really makes a difference. Mental preparation for competition, visualizing techniques, focus and concentration, developing routines to maintain focus through the race, especially during critical moments, and positive self-talk, using affirmations to boost morale and overcome negative thoughts during competition. And we could go on and on this, but I don't have all show to do this. But there are other things. Maybe I'll come back to this in another week. We talk a little bit about nutrition here, post-nutrition, pre-race nutrition, or we can call it pre-ride nutrition. All these things that are like super, super important. And yeah, I'm going to save this for another time. And we're going to move on to some other stuff because there's other stuff out there, which I had mentioned earlier, and it's time to move on. One of those was the New York Police Department de-escalates its bummer streets policing at this week's car-free DOT event. So Summer Streets was mostly, it's kind of a joyous event, but the NYPD came in this year and they decided to show up and kind of clog the streets and be more visually aware than they needed to be. They had blocker vehicles that remained only on side streets and not open the open roadway. And, they need to back off even a little bit more and let people have fun. There's just so much concern now with when you have big gatherings like this that things are going to go terribly wrong because someone is going to have a bad idea. But, that's what they were supposed to be there for. But unfortunately, there was a point like on one of the streets where a police car caused a choke point, which made all of the riders have to come to a very slow roll through. And I don't know if they were doing checks on people or what they were doing, but they really were out of place. And that's when this kind of went bad. And it's not necessary, and it's unfortunate, and it doesn't give the cyclists and the police officers a good relationship with one another if they are not working together. So anyway, there were people that were really upset with it. They said they never seen anything like the policing this year at the first Manhattan Saturday at previous Summer Streets. Said one woman who attends every year, their presence was palpable. Every car crossing street, there were 4 to 6 cop cars. Most of the cars were just parked with cops sitting inside looking at the route. You know, you want to be intimidating. If you're a police officer, you want to be intimidating, then you sit behind that smoked out window police car and don't ever get out. And you're just like, it just gives you a creepy feeling. And yet when I was in the bicycle industry and police cycling became a thing where the police officers were all riding on bicycles and loving it, by the way, they said the attitude towards everyone changed immediately because they were more approachable and more humanized. I think that's really the right way to do it, but who am I to say? I don't have control over that, and it seems that the current way of doing police enforcement is behind the doors of a giant SUV, and it's just kind of maddening to me. But anyway, so the overkill policy was a new policy by the NYPD Commissioner Jessica Tisch, who had been appointed by then Mayor Eric Adams, but held over as top cop by Mayor Mondani. He kept him there because powerful New Yorkers find him soft on crime. Maybe soft on crime isn't such a bad idea. Anyway, we'll move on. Let's find something else to talk about here because there's more on my list here. Okay, this one I just could not leave alone because as we talk about the UCI and their sock issues, whether it be cold socks or 6-inch tall socks or whatever, there's a new little thing that popped up in this year's Tour de Femme. And it is, the article is padded bra cheating claim rocks Tour de France femmes as bizarre theory swirls around cycling. The astonishing allegations have led to organizers modifying their pre-race protocols to ensure checks take place in closed tents. Give me a break. So the Tour de France femme riders are facing allegations of gaining an advantage through using padded bras. The women's edition of the biggest event, biggest race, began last Saturday and ran through basically Monday. I guess actually maybe today is the last day. I might have that wrong. This might be the Grand Parade. On Tuesday, the 21-kilometer time trial took place, and which consists of each rider setting off individually in a race against the clock. Classic time trial, right? Well, aerodynamics plays a crucial role at the time in a time trial performance. Remember the cold socks. With the skin suit, the rider position, helmet, and a host of other factors take into account the optimized flow of air around the body. And one of the areas that can create aerodynamic drag is around the chest, hence why the cyclists tuck into position when where their arms are outstretched in front of them. The Belgian and Dutch cycling publication Wielerfiets has reported there have been several complaints from cyclist World Tour teams alleging that padded sports bras are being used for aerodynamic advantage. Really? They claim riders are faking a larger cup size to reduce the drag through the air. Padded bras are banned under the rules of cycling's most world governing body, the Union of Cyclists International, otherwise known as the UCI. They just can't leave anything to rest. Teams reportedly called for inspectors to be introduced to check riders in a closed tent before time trials to ensure they're not hiding anything in their bras or under their aero clothing. Talk about invasive. This was then approved by the Tour de France femmes as riders appeared for bikes and outfit checks 10 minutes before the start of the time trial on Tuesday. You heard it here first, folks. Maybe you didn't hear it here first. Maybe this came through on your feed, but I saw this and I just went, this is an interesting subject. It's all theory at this point that a rounder chest is advantageous when it comes to aerodynamics. Now, I would love to see the wind tunnel test because I'm sure they're out there. I'm sure someone has figured this out at this point. But it's the fact that they're saying that if you, you know, pad your chest a little bit, you're going to get an aerodynamic advantage. Kind of like the socks, you know, they were talking about the cold socks in the men's Tour de France where they were, you know, putting these ice socks basically down their backs, which were keeping their bodies cool because it was 100 degrees Fahrenheit and they're trying to keep their core cool. But they said it was creating a hump and creating an airfoil of some sort, which gave them an aerodynamic advantage. Oh boy, I think the UCI needs to go on vacation. We don't really need them anymore. But yeah, there it is, folks. So does this mean, this is my question, that a woman who has a naturally larger chest is going to be faster on her bike than a woman who has a small chest? I doubt that very much. Anyway, that's what it is. I'll have to run this one by Fran, see what she thinks. It's too bad she's not here today because we would have a very interesting open discussion about this. Anyway, yeah, that's it. It was in my feed. I went for it. So, speaking of the Tour de Femme, Demi Vollering, it is over. She has won her second Tour de France. Yeah, or she just won the women's Tour de France for the second time. So there was some really good bicycle racing to watch on TV. Again, it was well covered once again. I think that the same network that covered the men's Tour de France was also covering the women's Tour de France. So that was kind of cool. And yeah, there was some great stuff in there for sure to watch. I unfortunately had spent most of my last week buried into the registrar's office up in Mansfield and also running early voting for 7 days. So my time at home, my leisure time at home to watch TV was not very good, and I couldn't stay awake for most of it. So anyway, I didn't get a chance to see a lot of it, but I did watch highlight reels, which were really, really exciting and good. So if you got a chance to, great. You know, drop me a note, tell me what you thought about it. And then we're going to move on to another subject here. And let's see here. Where is it? Let's go to the wrap-up page on the 2026 Tour de France. It was all Tade Pogacar. Tade. Until that really, really cool last stage. So the last stage of the Tour de France is classically the big parade into Paris. And it's usually a relatively joyous time because it's mostly been determined who's going to win the race, who's going to be in second, who's going to be third, who's got the polka dot jersey, who's got the green jersey, who's got the white jersey. It's pretty much set after 21 days of riding. The last year, because of the Olympics, I can't remember, but they changed the course. And it actually did not finish on the Champs-Élysées, but this year it did finish on the Champs-Élysées, which is really cool. So they still had that big sprint capacity at the end with the lead-out trains and all that stuff going on. But what happened instead is they put this little climb in that was a little ways outside of Paris, and they ended up going out to that little climb three times before the end of the race. Every single time that climb came into place, it effectively allowed all riders, not just GC riders, but also, you know, domestiques who were climbers, to have a chance at getting away and maybe even possibly staying away. So after a number of attempts, Tade Pogacar was just out to sign, seal, and deliver this tour, and he really wanted to win that last stage, which would have been unusual for a GC rider to win the last stage, just because they tend to have more skills in other areas, and they tend to not be the sprinter with the lead-out train, and they're not part of the gruppetto that it's barely hanging on to the tour for most of the race. So, but Tade was there attacking just like always, very aggressive. He did look tired at this point, to me anyway. So I think he may have made some mistakes in doing this, but you know what? He was determined and he was going to go for it. And there were numerous breakaways, of which he was initiating some of them. And it was fun to watch, but they'd always get reeled back in. The last one stuck. And it stuck because Tade was there with the famous Matthew Vanderpoel. Now, Matthew Vanderpoel is a wattage king. That man can put out a lot of wattage. He's a great classic rider. He has an amazing amount of power in his legs. He is known to produce well over 1,000 watts of power when he needs to. And I've watched him win races like the Tour de Flanders, where he just put the hammer down on the cobbles, on the 14% cobbles near the end of the race, and literally left everyone behind, and then maintained 400 watts of power for the rest of the race. It's sort of superhuman. It's hard to believe that anybody can do that, but Matthew can do that. So now Tade and Matthew are away. And classically, what happens is that little breakaway always gets caught by the big sprint trains that are coming up behind. But they're not gaining on them, because you got Tade Pogacar, definitely the best cyclist in the world right now all round, and you've got Matthew Vanderpoel, one of the classic specialists in the early classic rides, and they're together. And they're working together, and they got it going on. And I'm looking at this, and Tade is just, I know what he's thinking. He's thinking, if I can just stay on Vanderpoel's wheel, I might have a chance at winning the final stage of the Tour de France. And Vanderpoel's thinking, I got to keep this guy with me, because he's strong enough for me to maybe possibly get a stage win out of this. So they're both thinking the same thing, but they're also very cooperatively working with one another. It was exciting, exciting, exciting. They're finally coming in, and the Peloton is creeping up on them. It's getting closer and closer, and Matthew Vanderpool takes a glance, realizes that, you know, there's a possibility they're going to get caught, and puts a couple more watts into his power. I think he got up close to 1,000 watts from what they were saying. We got some specifics from Yahoo because they, or Wahoo, excuse me, because they have, they're a sponsor for the team, but they don't like to share numbers, these guys, anymore, because it's like giveaway our secret. I don't know why they don't do it, but they don't do it. So anyway, he put on this little burst, you know, it's like, you know, stay on my wheel, here we go. And Pogacar just like shook his head and looked over his shoulder, saw the Peloton coming and faded back. Now, Vanderpool's all by himself. And he is just giving it all he can to stay out there. This big sprint comes up behind him. He wins it by an inch. And he wins the final stage of the Tour de France. And it was exciting. It was really, really exciting. I love it when a breakaway gets away and pulls it off on a stage that they shouldn't have been there. I think that's my favorite part of bicycle racing. So anyway, it was real exciting. It was real fun to watch. Vanderpool was in a pile on the road afterwards. He was all crumpled up in fetal position and sobbing and just completely exhausted. He had used everything he had to be able to pull that off. A true champion for sure. It was just, there was emotion, there was excitement. It was, you know, that's why we watch bike racing. It's fun. It's really, really fun. So anyway, Pogacar, though, he is now a 5-time winner of the Tour de France. And that means that he is placed in the elite company of Jacques Anquetil, Eddie Merckx, Bernard Hinault, and Miguel Indurain. So these are all names from my past. I remember a lot of these guys. I wasn't around for Jacques Anquetil, but I definitely was around for all the others. And he had a famous victory on the Alpe d'Huez on the Friday afternoon before the finish. Pogacar worked on Saturday to keep his teammate Isaac Del Toro secure in the white jersey, the young rider's jersey, which Pogacar had worn for many years. Pogacar won his first Tour de France when he was 20 years old, the day before his 21st birthday. And so, you know, that was exciting. It's just that last day. You know, they had no more than a 10-second gap on the Peloton, and Vanderpool pulls it off. Just really great, great, great stuff. Second overall for Remco Evenepoel, which is definitely very good. He had an outstanding race. There was a big time gap. Obviously, there was he was 6:26 behind Pogacar. But, of course, we lost Jonas Vingegaard, who was much, much closer because of a bad crash. And still haven't heard anything about that. I have to do some research on that to see if Jonas is recovering from, I believe, a broken collarbone. I think he broke his collarbone on that crash, which is really unfortunate. And so, anyway, it was just a great race. There was all sorts of cool, cool stuff to watch. And lots of excitement, lots of crazy climbs, lots of attacks. It's just everything you want to see in a good Tour de France. So very exciting, good time. And I'm sad it's over because, you know, I would rather just keep watching bicycle racing forever. But the Vuelta a España is coming. So we're going to have another classic big time tour showing up here towards the end of, I think it's the end of August, early September is when we start that. I don't have the date in front of me right now, but we got more coming, and boy, with the weather and the heat that they've had over in Europe this year, and the Vuelta a España is always known as classically the hottest race of the year, I can't imagine what they're going to be going through, and maybe they'll allow them to use the ice sock. Anyway, my comment. So let's see here. I got not much time left, actually. I had an article here from Bicycle Retailer, which, again, I can go back on this, but it was written by a gentleman by the name of Pat Cunane, who's been in the industry for a really, really long time. And it was all about e-bikes and the industry fighting against itself and the major problems that people see are not caused by the e-bikes that meet the Consumer Product Safety Commission's definition of an e-bike. They're not caused by Class 3 e-bikes that require pedal assistance to exceed 20 miles per hour. The problem has two main causes. Bikes that fall outside of on Class 1 and 2 and have a throttle can go faster than 20 miles per hour, and often much faster, like 40 or 50 miles per hour. That incredibly fast acceleration is really where the problem is. The industry is often calling these e-motos or out-of-class products, but most people can't tell the difference. They just see an e-bike. Riders who are riding recklessly, speeding, weaving, ignoring stop signs and red lights, laws that are already enforceable but are not being enforced. So that is the two main problems. What seems like our industry should agree on is that low-speed electric bikes are defined and regulated by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. More than 40 states have accepted and integrated into their definitions the Class 3 definitions created and advocated for by the bicycle industry for the bicycle industry. You know, I have an e-bike, and my e-bike is, if I keep it in my general level 3, I will be rolling in around 17 miles an hour on the average, and it's pretty fast. You're definitely scooting along. If I want to push it up to level 4, I can hit 20, but I'm just not really, I'm not interested in that. I use it to commute with. So there's the e-bike debate will go on forever, and we will talk about it forever because it's very popular right now, and there's a real good reason why. I am completely running out of time here, so I have got to wrap this thing up. So I'm going to ask you to give us your opinion. TikTok gas prices, guess what? They're going up again. We got a war going on. Isn't it lovely? Not lovely. But, you know, if it jacks up the price of gas, then, you know, it's not really, you know, that much of a concern for me. I would like to see it do that because maybe you'll pick up a bike and figure it out and discover that thing that you had when you were a child, depending on your bicycle. And your world will really change. Remember, bicycling is freedom. Life is better when more people ride bikes. Cycling is an easier and safer option for more people because when more people bike, people are happier, they're healthier, they are friendlier, they're safer, our communities are safer, and our planet is greener. Together, you know, we need to all tell everybody about the joy of bicycling. I'm going to say it again. It won't be my last time. You got to get loud, get active. Our time has come. It's right now. Stop complaining about traffic and dangerous roads and the price of gas and the lack of places to safely ride your bike and do your part. And hey, take that pedal and run challenge. Consider parking your car for a day and just use your bike instead. You will surprise yourself. And the views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk, and I am Pedalin' Ron. And remember, keep that rubber side down, the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Get on your bikes and ride!